Thank you for listening to the Impact Leaders Podcast, featuring leaders in sustainable and impact investment, sharing their stories, experiences, and advice to increase awareness and highlight best practices in order to help us transition more capital into the industry faster. I am grateful that you're choosing to invest your time to listen to our guests, since I know that you're going to feel encouraged and inspired. I am JP Dalman, founder and CEO of ILM Partners, and we're the proud sponsors of the podcast. ILM Partners is an advisory and soon-to-launch multi-asset management firm targeting to acquire and scale investment funds focused on sustainability and impact, one of the fastest-growing areas of investment management globally, enabling investors to generate returns with confidence whilst having a net positive impact in the world. Our mission is to facilitate and accelerate the transition of $5 billion of capital to sustainable impact investing in the next 5 years. If you would like to explore the opportunity of working together, email contact@ilmpartners.com for an introductory and confidential conversation. Your support means everything to us, since it's what really keeps us going. So make sure you share our work with someone that will benefit from it. Please remember to subscribe to get the notifications and check the notes from each episode. We hope you enjoy today's special conversation. Hello, everyone, and welcome to a new episode of Impact Leaders. I hope everyone is very well and healthy and managing the best you can. Today's episode of Impact Leaders is technically the sixth on our current series called Sustainable Investment Dilemma, looking into how industries can help address the climate and social crisis, in particular, the financial industry, taking on the opportunity to find and fund the solutions that we need for a sustainable future. Although today, we bring a different angle and industry to gain and give some extra inspiration to our listeners. In order to do that, we have a very special guest today, and that is yours truly, Sir Tim Smith. Good afternoon. Good afternoon. How are you today?
I am explosively good. I am very happy today.
I like that. And where are you today? I'm assuming Cornwall, but you never know.
I'm in Cornwall. I am in the town of Wade Bridge on the River Camel, halfway between the north and the south. But I don't want to make your listeners jealous, because I'm literally only 5 miles from the beautiful north coast one way and 15 miles from the beautiful south coast the other. Must be so hard to be in London.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, it's interesting. I don't share all the time, but we know we are being listened in about over 100 countries. And, you know, the UK is kind of a big percentage, but it's quite nice, you know, that it has an international reach. So if anyone, this is going to be interesting, because it's another first for the episode. And maybe some people may have never heard of Cornwall, and definitely some of the very exciting and interesting parts that we're going to talk about, you know, I'm sure that people are going to be extremely, extremely inspired. And given that we will be focusing on some, I would put it within kind of the nature-based solutions part, I don't know if you'll agree, including land regeneration and much more, I'm very excited to have your team, you know, because I think that I'm looking forward to the kind of talking about some of the lessons learned and experience, kind of the great need, you know, and potential to do more, you know, in terms of what you're doing and what needs to be done, specifically in some of the areas that you are working, and how potentially, you know, the pandemic has impacted the way people, investors and companies, and the way we look at nature and land and environment kind of has affects and provides for our societal needs, and how it can has changed, you know, because I think that it's been a big, or at least that's how it feels when I talk to people, that it's been a kind of a swift or a change on the attention, right? So maybe, I don't know if you want to comment on that first, and then I would like to give a proper introduction to you, if that's okay.
Well, thank you. I think the pandemic has had a number of profound impacts. The first and little spoken about impact is every single CEO that I know, and I know a lot of them, has been more influenced by their children over the breakfast table as they've been in lockdown, talking about the world that they expect mummy or daddy to deliver for them, than anything else. I think any amount of environmental pressure groups could not have done anything like the power of all of the youngsters saying to their mums and dads, come on, step up to the plate. It's time of change, and we want to make sure that we're proud of mummy and daddy. And I think that's really, really important. I think the other thing that is interesting is the arrogance of nationhood has been proved to be just that when you see the way the pandemic has been no respecter at all of national boundaries. And it has done in 8 months what I think an education system would have taken between 30 and 50 years to do, which is to demonstrate that we are all interconnected. And I think this is a profound realization for a lot of people, and I think sets us up beautifully to look at systems afresh in a way that is, yes, it's about the environment. Yes, it's about living within the boundaries of the planet. But most importantly, I mean, this is a business program that we're on here. It is actually waking people up to the fact that businesses are ecosystems, and the way they operate, the way they're managed, the moral compass by which they are set are all profound influences of the world within worlds that business represents.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. And I can completely relate to both points. You know, one, and I think I mentioned in one of my other episodes, you know, my daughter, after watching Seaspiracy, came downstairs and banned us from eating fish in the house, which is, you know, quite something, right? And then on the international business side, or the interconnectivity, I would say, you know, it's fascinating. You know, I always mention to you offline how, and I should actually give it the credit straight away, but the power of a Clubhouse, you know, we connected and then we are connected with other people and everyone is trying to, you know, contribute and help and support, you know, each other at the personal and business level. So yes, I'm completely with you on that. So let me take a minute or two. I'm going to just read a short version of your bio that I kind of collected, if that's okay.
Only if it's really short. I mean, yeah. You know.
So it's just for a bit of context, you know, so in case people haven't met you before, you know, it's just that to share with the audience, you know, a short introduction to the outstanding and unique life I believe you have had so far, you know, just for the context of the benefit. So, and I like it because I'm going to say full name here is Sir Timothy Bartle Smith. And I know that you don't like being called Timothy because I learned that. But it's Sir Tim Smith, KBE. He's a Dutch-born British businessman, famous for his work on the Lost Gardens of Heligan and the Eden Project and the Charlestown Shipwreck and Treasure Center as well.
That's another one. Yeah. Yep.
So he's the executive vice chair and co-founder of the multi-award-winning Eden Project in Cornwall. Since its opening in 2001, over 22 million people have come to see the what was one sterile pit, and now converted into something that is, you know, beyond beautiful and educational on many levels. To put it simple, he's also the executive and co-chair of the Eden Project International, which we'll talk about a little bit later, which aims to have an Eden Project on every habited continent by 2025. Be interesting to see the vision and how it's going. And he's also obviously known, you know, for all his achievements in Cornwall, you know, that he discovered and restored the Lost Gardens on Heligan, which we'll mention with John Nelson, which has been actually in 18, I think it was awarded Garden of the Year by BBC Country Life. And he also has a book about that and a book about the Eden Project, which, you know, maybe we get the time as well to speak a little bit about. But the fascinating thing, you know, and I know, and that this is for my benefit as well, because, you know, when we had the other conversation the other day, I wasn't as prepared. The fascinating thing is that you started as an archaeologist before making kind of a move leap into music. And I had not realized, but you actually received a platinum and gold discs. So it was not just a simple career, right? And then obviously the rest came, you know, they lost the moving to Cornwall and the projects and the initiative. And one point that I picked up, I do like numbers, and this is kind of our audience tends to be investor focused. You know, the initial budget was of £80 million to build the two transparent biomes in an old China clay. But it is said that you have the project, you know, and the Eden Project has contributed to over £1 billion. Of kind of revenue into the Cornish economy. So it's fascinating to see, you know, all those points, I think. And then finally, just to say, I think it's very much worth to share, you know, that the fact that you got appointed honorary Knight Commander of the Order of the British Empire, which is the KBE, which I mentioned before in 2011. And then there is something special as well in, I think, in May 2012, when you became a British citizen, which is which now, you know, that's why I started with the Sir Tim before, but I don't think you actually used the Sir much. I've seen it around, it's always Tim Smith, right? And then lastly, which you taught me, which is the first thing already I learned, your name is a palindrome.
Ah, very good.
Yeah, I made a note of that, which is because if you think, people think about it, it's Tim Smith. So it reads both ways the same way. So we call it in Spanish, capicua, which is not, doesn't sound as good, as interesting, but.
No, I like a capicua. That's really good. That's marvelous. And anybody listening who's got another good palindrome to share, I collect palindromes. I have, my favorite one is a man, a plan, a canal, Panama.
My, very nice. Okay, I like that. And then you mentioned one to me, since you mentioned that, there was one which is 240 words long. George Perec.
Yeah, the great French thinker and mathematician. No, it was 240 pages long.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Look, this guy was, I mean, obviously he would have been difficult to live with, but the palindrome is in words, not the letters. It's not like Tim Smith. It would be, the words would be the same at the end. Are you with me? So
yeah,
it would be,
yeah.
Smith, Tim at the end and Tim Smith at the other end of the all the sentences. But he also did something absolutely mad. He wrote a detective novel in French without using the letter E.
Yeah, remember you mentioned that.
I mean, that is just, I'm so full of admiration for doing something so useless and so brilliant.
Well, I can remember now, but there's a book about that, about doing, it was at an event, I remember, it was about doing things that we think are useless, but that can become very impactful over time. And many of those things actually are in science, you know, to begin with, which people don't believe in. But let me start with the first question, which is, what is sustainable and impact investing to your eyes and experience, Tim?
Gosh, I love those trivial questions straight off. Okay, first of all, I think the distinction between investment and impact investment is childish, because all investment has an impact. Therefore, to deny that is actually, in a sense, to try and make something positive in terms of what is called sustainability out of impact investing. But I think an awful lot of what is called impact investing isn't actually that impactful. I think it often gets greenwashed at one level, but is also intellectually sometimes not as intelligent as it could be, by which I mean the following. You said that Eden actually has created over £2.2 billion of extra wealth, the Grail statistic. But the reason is because of our politics. I am commercial. Although the Eden Project is a charitable trust, it is run by companies of whom the shareholders are the charity. So what we are doing is trying to make profits or surpluses for it with a purpose. Because I am a great believer that, except when it is your intent not to make a surplus and you have deliberately said, I am not going to, and the surplus will be in terms of brand or welfare or something else, I believe that it's a good measure of the effectiveness with which you operate if you can make a surplus as measured by whatever the definition is you have of that surplus. So at Eden, I was much influenced by something that happened to me right at the beginning, which may be very interesting to your listeners. I went to a town called Cwmbran, which is in Wales, in 1996. When I decided to build the Eden Project, I thought I would go to visit the people who had organized the last big event in Britain, which was a garden festival paid for by the government. They took place every 4 years, and they had begun in 1984, and this was going to be the last one. And it had not been a great success. I went to see the people who had run this garden festival, and I was the luckiest man in the world. The people who ran it decided they would share with me every mistake that they had made. Mm. And I'm absolutely honest, I would have made half of those mistakes myself had I not been warned. And the advice they gave is just brilliant, and I now give it to everybody else I talk to. The first thing they said was, the problem is when we arrived here, we saw our whales, as in Wales, the country. We saw our whales. we did not stop to see the real Wales. They brought with them all the prejudice they had or pre-thoughts they had about what Wales was, and they missed some very, very big tricks. Wales was famous for big industry, big steel, big coal, and so on. But actually, at the time of the Garden Festival, big steel and coal were in huge decline, and many, many of the tens of thousands of unemployed people had formed small businesses. And so their first advice was, if we had known, if we had thought, we would have started planning 2 years before we did, so that all of these small businesses could have benefited from what we were going to be doing at the Garden Festival. As it was, we came so late to the table that only 6 months before did we think about ordering the uniforms we needed, the stuff for the shops, the catering, or, you know, all of the stuff. Which meant that almost all the money that was meant to be invested in Wales through that Garden Festival hemorrhaged to big companies outside Wales. And that, yes, that really made me think about Eden. So when we began building the Eden project, well before the foundations went in, we had started to talk to companies that were going to supply us. We started talking to the colleges about the sort of staff we would need. And
all the local stakeholders, yeah,
absolutely. And it was revolutionary because it meant that we were able to take our local stakeholders, as you rightly call them, with us on the journey. Also, and this is a criticism of many commercial people, we thought about what do local businesses need if they're going to supply something that is going to become big. You know as well as I do, JP, that if you are a small ice cream maker and you have only short-term contracts, but you need to treble your company, is there any bank that is going to lend you the money to treble your company in terms of what you can do? No, there isn't. That is why you must be positive in your capitalism. If you're going to do this, give your ice cream supplier a 3-year contract and tell them that if they have all sorts of performance points that they that we demand, like having zero waste and so on, at the end of 3 years, you will extend that contract. By using capitalist processes, commercial processes, we were able to have huge environmental impact and business impact in terms of creating solidity, a reason for training, a reason for interconnection. In truth, what we were doing was creating a system all around us that was going to be mutually beneficial. And we're very, very proud of that. And that is why we're now building in many countries of the world, because the citizens who are in those countries have approached us and said, we want our towns, our cities to benefit by that type of thinking.
Okay, that's fascinating. So can I just double check two things? So the point one was the lessons, right? So they looked at the old Wales. And the second one?
The second one is, if you really want to create environmental and economic advantage in your local community, you must understand the processes of contract and supply chain and procurement and deliver those for the people you want to be long-term partners for you.
I hear you. And just out of curiosity, is the Garden Festival still going?
No, that was the last Garden Festival. But look, your question was about what does impact investment mean to me?
Yes, and I wrote it like this way. So if I had to, like, from what I listen, it's a commercially focused system, mutually beneficial to all the stakeholders. That's what I heard.
Yes, to which I would add that true impact investment would understand also that it would be investing in terms of creating systems, reinforcing systems. Part of the problem we all face is that the things that we are trying to deal with are called by academics wicked problems or super wicked problems. And that when you have a situation where so far commercialism, capitalism, if you like, the global compact, is focused on maximizing a short-term prosperity profit, whereas I think impact investment, true impact investment, is attuned with that word legacy. It is also attuned with the concept of there being planetary boundaries. It is also attuned to the human-made constraints of the Sustainable Development Goals. it surely must be, or else you cannot be called an impact investment. And then many of your listeners will be thinking, okay, how does one create a sustainable financial stroke commercial ecology that enables it to do the job to be impactful? Because the truth is, as you know, that you cannot impact invest if you haven't got enough money or enough intelligence to create the systems to make it a bit like a friendly invading economic army. Do you know what I mean? That if you can't do the whole job, you could end up doing a lot of damage. So in Australia, there's a big impact investment fund we know very well that we've been talking to. They've bought 75,000 hectares of degraded cattle land. And you will know that there are many funds actually like that. Look, for example, in Mexico, in Argentina, where people are buying large chunks of land for impact investment. And their version of impact investment is actually allied to regenerative farming or doing ecologically sustainable things on the land that they have purchased. And their single market is actually, well, their biggest single market is the carbon sequestration in terms of the carbon price on the land that they have. I think this is actually quite stupid. I mean, the two big funds we're talking about, we've got them very excited about how do you create a mixed economy on land that you are regenerating, but also realizing that you want to, in any country of the world, stop the big drift of humans to the cities and create in what was the countryside the abilities for people to have full lives that are living within planetary boundaries. And that's, for example, what you're seeing now in China. You're seeing that in China, where they're trying to move people out of cities by creating in the countryside the things or potential to enjoy those things which people were previously going to cities for.
I hear you. Yeah. And one point you mentioned there that kind of resonated, and this is fascinating because as obvious as it is, I don't think that people think about it, but the point about reinforcing the system and the local ecosystem. A wonderful man I met also through Clubhouse, Stuart Williams out of Charleston in South Carolina. He's an impact investor, and he was giving some of the statistics of how much of the kind of revenue created, you know, in the state, they calculated, goes out, you know, to others, right? So, which I think is the point you mentioned about the story with the garden event, right? And it's, you know, to be, you know, truly impactful at that level, you know, people need to start getting that notion that you need to start looking. And I'm just, again, fascinated by the thought of, you know, how the planning ahead and including all the stakeholders, which again, a lot of people don't realize that you need to do a bit like gardening, you need to prepare the grounds, right?
Yes.
A lot. You have to work on it a lot before you can plant, before you can actually see anything coming out, just to mention an analogy. The second part of this question is, and it kind of links to this. So the fact that we are growing, the fact that we are growing the cities, you know, populations, now we're trying to pull people outside of cities, you know, and there is, I don't know if you have seen, but the sustainable investment, it kind of, are we facing a sustainable investment dilemma? That's the question. And it came out of the fact that we've been funding, you know, the financial services industry, banks in particular, have been funding those same products and solutions that have created the problem. So in your view, and perhaps also from, you know, the work that you're doing, do you see that dilemma in terms of, you know, where we're putting the money versus what we're doing, taking the action?
If I was answering honestly, I just basically see stupid middle-aged men making really bad investments. I don't see a fundamental contradiction here at all. I think the trouble is too many people are like sheep and they do not think. I'll give you an example, right? You and I are going to do some impact investing. We'll go to Argentina, right? I will tell you a word which is incredibly damaging, which everybody thinks is very wholesome. Farm. The word farm, you cannot help it. Almost anybody who hears the word farm, they see a cockerel, they see chickens, they see pigs, a few livestock, beautiful fields and all the rest of it. If you stopped calling these places farms and talked to them as being rural centers, you would then revolutionize the way you look at the countryside. You would actually see rural centers where you should have outposts for urban schools to go into the country to learn what the country that they live in is. They should be places of health and well-being, where people who have suffered various calamities in their life can come and recharge their batteries. All of these things, education and well-being, are really major ones, but within it also is access to the land for people who have not been farmers all their lives, who do not want to form a farm, you know, 20,000 hectares of soy or something like that. We're seeing this in Britain. There are young kids in the age group 19 to, let's say, 27. I've made that up, but in that age, who desperately want to grow things and want to create markets out of what they grow, niche products to create niche forms of food and drink. And they're very successful. They can make money on 5 to 7 acres of, in new money, call it 3 to 4 hectares. Yeah. And we're not doing nearly enough to encourage people to see the land as being a joyous way of both nurturing our populations, creating a range of new businesses, because no one is looking at the land in terms of regenerating it other than making the soil healthier. So if you and I go to Argentina and we take over, because it's a round figure, 1,000 hectares of land, and we then say we want 100 Argentinian young couples to come and share that land, right? And we're not only going to do that, we are going to create small factories on that land where they can make the whole process work of the crops that they're growing, the processing of them, the packaging of them, so that you can, all of what you want to make as your final product, you're keeping in muscular local centers. You will revolutionize the countryside. You will stop people leaving the countryside. And then people in the cities will start to see the countryside as being an adjunct, an addition to themselves, rather than a rather strange place that you just go on holiday.
Yeah, personally, I can relate because I've moved from the city out to the countryside. I interestingly fought it at the beginning because it wasn't my idea. But as I've kind of learned to, and I actually COVID helped even more, you know, learn to embrace it. You understand, you know, that is the most wonderful and beautiful option you can actually have. But we have a fascination for cities still, I would have said, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The intellectual wealth, the cultural wealth of going to a marvelous city, whether it be London or Paris or Buenos Aires or Berlin, whatever. I mean, most of the great cities of the world are great cities because you are suddenly reintroduced to the mass of humanity from all over the world, which makes you feel as if you've fallen into the most gorgeous cultural soup. And you miss that. When you go into the countryside, you miss that. And I think it's childish for either you or I to pretend that the countryside is better in everything. It isn't. You want a rich life, is a polymathic life with different interests.
Let me just add the slight turn, but based on what you just talked about, because it's fascinating. You mentioned the commerciality effectively when you talked about changing the name of farms to rural centers. You're talking about a little bit of marketing / you know, PR there as well. So all very commercial ways, you know, to just, you know, repackage in the, something that we have an emotional association to make it even more attractive, right? Which brings me to something. So I picked up through some of the comments you have made about social enterprise and entrepreneurship, for example. Right? Yeah. And this is something that you just actually hit the head of the nail on, something that I keep seeing on entrepreneurs coming and ask me. And not even entrepreneurs, I've seen it actually, entrepreneurs, and I've seen it with large institutions, investment management firms that are trying to launch, you know, impact funds, for example, or sustainable investment products, that they're missing some of the points around how to speak about it, how to convey the message, how to explain, you know, what they're trying to do, and then connect that to the needs of the, in this case, the investors. But the same happens, you know, when you go all the way down to somebody that wants to set up an Eden project for the first time, or somebody that's just trying to create a renewable packaging product firm, right? So, but you mentioned a couple of points about how we are about risk in the UK, particularly how, you know, the stigma of failure. So anything that you can share around that, you know, and specifically the mindset, I was thinking, what is the mindset that somebody is trying to do something social or environmentally impactful needs to think about?
One of the things though, JP, I'm finding really difficult is you're trying to put me into a slot, a definition of environmental or whatever. I'm interested in everything, absolutely everything, because I think everything needs to work with everything else in order for us to have a healthy planet. And that is why I am commercially interested. I spend a lot of my time thinking about the interface between being commercial and ending up with the social ends that we all think would be highly desirable in our culture. And no country has yet managed to succeed in this area. So it is quite obvious we are not clever enough. Whether you be in Argentina or France or America or England, we all recognize that it is a shameful thing that the gap between the poor and the rich in each of those marvelous countries is greater today than it was 100 years ago. This is quite frankly disgusting. And it's really disgusting because those of us who consider ourselves to be commercial get tainted or stained by the notion that it is a flaw of capitalism, that there will always have to be huge depths of reserves of the have-nots to serve those who have. And this is just quite simply not true. It is to do with the poverty of moral compass within many of the practitioners of capitalism. We should not all be stained by the bad behaviors of others. Let me put it to you this way. Do you personally, JP, believe that clean water ought to be available to all and that anybody who actually pollutes the clean water, which is the commons, is committing an offense? Do you?
Yes and yes.
Okay. So you are a capitalist, I am a capitalist, and I still think it's almost treasonable to life on Earth to poison the rivers. Therefore, why are we not strong enough as people to say, I'm a capitalist, but you, sir, are a bastard for actually poisoning our river, and you should be put out of business. End of story. This is nothing to do with capitalism. It is to do with the unacceptable greed of people who do not pay the true price for maintaining nature in the balance it should have been in the first place. The same goes if I ask that question about clean air, you would say yes and yes. If I ask you, do you think it should be criminal for people to so degrade the land that it is turned to dust and is infertile to turn the microbe? You'd say yes. These are just simple judgments about being citizens of planet Earth. And I think it is the duty of capitalism to make sure that if pulling down the wall in 1989 was the great victory of capitalism, the greatest challenge of the 50 years since then has got to be to prove it was worth winning. And if we can't make sure that our children live in an environment in which the air isn't poisoned or the rivers aren't poisoned and the soil is producing food, then we have failed. The system has failed. And I believe very much, actually, in the power of commerce and capitalism to be a power for good. And I think the weakness, coming back to middle-aged men, is an awful lot of good people have stood around while a lot of bad people have actually managed to pervert the English language or whichever language they're speaking to imply that commerce is good at any price. It is not. To be honest, I think that the ultimate thing under any company, if we're talking about impact investment, is that in no case ever, should the law of the marketplace trump the laws of nature.
I think that it all points, extremely powerful, and I got a lot more than I bargain for on that question. Because, and just for the record, for you and for everyone listening, it's not, I think, that I am, I don't know if you use the word painting, but painting you as neither, an environmentalist or anything like that. I completely get it. I am a capitalist myself, and I really picking up on that commercial point, which I really appreciate, because it's what I'm trying to teach, people at all levels. With some of the, even a program we just launched this week, it was born out of that, because I realized that there is that gap where there is some people trying to do great, good, but they just don't have these, let's put it simple, commercial skills to be able to then make a sustainable business model. And then in that case, you cannot have any impact, right? So put it simple, it's profit and impact. And I have it more clear than ever before, you have to create profit and so that you can have an impact. All obviously with the work that you do before to understand what the impact that you're going to create is going to be, which is what I'm picking up from you. So, and if I speak like that, by the way, Tim, is because I think the podcast, I tend to speak like that. It's kind of, it's around the environment and normally on the investment side, but.
That's fine. Can I throw a challenge down at you then?
Please, please.
Okay. All right. I just talked about clean water. If you do believe, like I do, that clean water ought to be available to everybody on earth, normally when I speak to a large audience, I ask them a question. I say, how many people in this room donate small amounts of money every month to those lovely charities that provide clean water around the world? And most of the room will put a hand up. Then ask the next question. How many people in this audience believe those charities are capable of creating clean water or delivering clean water to the world? And no one will put their hand up. No one, not a single person. And the thing that really, really pisses me off about the current debate about any subject is the way we have painted ourselves into corners of prejudice. Because you know what? The only companies that could actually, or organizations that could provide clean water all over the world, have names which most activists could hardly bear to do other than spit out. They're called BP, Shell, ExxonMobil, Aramco. You keep on, Total, you keep naming them. So who in our culture is starting a discourse which enables a positive dialogue to take place between big old capital to enable them to reinvent themselves on behalf of all of our citizens to run successful clean companies? Because no company I know has ever changed its mind about something or changed its direction of travel through being screamed at or shouted at. So who, in your opinion, who can have that discussion? It is so important for society and planet Earth. Yet nowhere do I look politically in any system. Is there anybody talking about capitalism with a moral compass that redresses some of the old technologies that no longer suit our direction of travel to make sure we don't lose all the talents that are so crucial for the future of project management, technology, all of that sort of stuff? We cannot afford to lose those talents. So how can you have that invitation to big companies to come to the table to use their power and their intelligence for a different purpose?
Okay, I'm going to take that one away, I think, Tim. But what I will do as well is I will pass on the challenge to anyone listening and do share, because what I'm, you know, as I connect more and more with people around the world, I keep learning about so many great initiatives taking place. You know, like, the one thing I think you make a point is that it's hard to see sometimes is where all the different, and just to use the word again, all the different stakeholders are coming together. So you mentioned all the big brands, you know, they have their, and sometimes they have their initiatives. You know, we are, for example, trying to help support Unilever in delivering their transformation project for LATAM, for example, but it's very specific, you know, to the sector, to the products. What you're talking about is something kind of a couple of levels above, I would say, in terms of, you know, that conversation. And then obviously I see, as we know, right, the different organizations around the world in the different sectors, like the World Economic Forum or, you know, yeah, the G7, and it's going to happen near you, I think, and others, right? But that kind of all round table conversation, yes. If anyone knows as well, please reach out and let me know. Aside from even like we have COP26, right, coming up in 6 months. In Scotland, it's fascinating to see now, you know, through, again, I'm going to mention Clubhouse maybe more times than ever in this episode, but through there, you realize that there's still a disconnect between, you know, people going to that event and the rest of the population, right? Which is, tends to be this kind of elite versus the masses, right? Which I observe. And even, I don't know at what point the best time to mention this, but even I think you are looking at doing a project for the UK with Philanthropy and the Eden Project soon as well, which is just to, again, bring a group of people together with a common interest, right?
Well, we've been doing quite a lot of that. Since 2009, we've had an event called The Big Lunch, which has got royal patronage and things. But the idea was simply to knock on the door of your neighbours and have lunch, because any area where you get to know your neighbours actually becomes a neighbourhood. And one of the problems is a lot of people lazily talk about community as being a line on a map. It isn't. Community comes from a word. word, communos, together in gift. It's about action. It's not about inaction. So we have about 6.5 million people a year do that. And in terms of convening people, in terms of business leaders and all of that sort of stuff, we do it, but actually we're becoming less interested in it. I know that Prince Charles has started Terra Carta, which I think is a really good initiative. But I'm actually more focused personally on education. I'm passionate about education, but not the sort of education which is the sort of thing where parents go, oh, isn't that nice? That's a really worthwhile thing. It's about how do you create citizens? I mean, the big battleground for you, for me, for everybody listening is how do we stop just being consumers and start talking about ourselves as citizens that have responsibility? I mean, you will have noticed, I mean, the lack of respect for politicians, which is
yes,
felt all over the world. This isn't just Britain or America or whatever, but in large part, it's our fault. It's our fault. The most expensive, the most watched thing we have at the Eden Project is a big wall on which someone has painted, if the world was shrunk to a village of 100 people, and with it, there are all these statistics about the demographics of where people would have come from, the income groups, the life expectancy, their access to various resources. And the public just cannot help themselves. They're so fascinated. The moment you've got down to 100 people, they can now in their head start to understand ideas, which when you talk about thousands, millions, billions, you can't. And something we do at Eden is we do, when we get people together, we say, right, if we lived, for example, in Wadebridge, where I live, and we put a castle wall right around Wadebridge, what do we need? We need to have some people that stop wolves eating us. We need people to pick up our sewage. And, you know, you make a list of all of it. And at the end of it, you realize that you will be costing three times more than you will earn in taxes, because we, the citizens, want that, right? Like consumers, spoiled children, we want that. So the politicians cannot succeed now. They cannot succeed because we want, and we use the word they must do, to politicians to give us what we have ridiculously asked for. The next part of this conversation for any person or business ought to be, okay, what cost can we take out of this system by, okay, I will mow the lawns, the public lawns. You will do the hedges. You will do the litter. You know, you take the cost down until you've got something that you can afford. But we never have that sort of education in schools or anything. Ridiculously, we want to learn about the medieval kings and queens of Britain or something rubbish like that. But we won't want to teach people how to grow something or how to cook something or how to have a conversation that doesn't end in war. There you go. I've stopped ranting.
No, that's gold. That's gold. Because let me just see if I can keep my thoughts, my mental notes as well and make sense of what I'm going to say. But before I forget, communities together in gift. Is that what you said?
I'm
going to make that because, you know, I've been truly enjoying my first experience of the most wonderful community, you know, with my church in Tunbridge Wells, which I have never experienced on that level. And then it just fascinates me, together in gift, that you mentioned that I've learned another meaning. Thank you for that. And then also I take advantage to share the light on the back of Terra Carta. There is the Sustainable Markets Initiative. If people in the sector haven't heard about it, you know, I've just met with a friend, a colleague of mine recently, Stephen Lizards, and he told me about it. And it's fascinating what they're doing. It's not only locally, but across the Commonwealth. And then again, I'm kind of taking a turn from the questions I have prepared, but I have to ask you. So how do we change the, and I know that we can talk for hours on this just alone, Tim, but how do we change that part about the education? Because I live, I see it with my daughters, you know, what they're learning, how they're learning, and the system continues, and even in some of the best schools, you know, in the country, in this case, right? So what does need to happen so that we have that change to become more practical and commercial and set people for a sustainable society?
Well, as a question, it's a brilliant question which completely soothes the vanity of anybody asked it. A dear friend of mine, who sadly died in August, was Sir Ken Robinson, who was the, you know, god of creative education. And we became very good chums late in his life, and he joined our board at Eden. And he said to me something very interesting. He said, if I was given £1,000 for every time someone has suggested what the curriculum should be, change the world, I would be a billionaire. He said, the truth is, it's not really as simple as what's in the curriculum. It is about your approach to education and making a distinction between qualification and an education. And in an education, you are trying to fitness train your curiosity in the world. You're trying to understand how systems work together. And you're also trying to discover at a fundamental level what for you personally are the elements that make you happy. I've seen, because it's an interest, I've seen lots of stuff on this. And it is true. There's a school, a very famous school that some people listening may have heard of, called the Manchester Project in Pittsburgh, where Bill Strickland, who started it, he had been a homeless boy in his youth. And then eventually, through one twist of fortune and another, he went to Harvard, came back to Pittsburgh and built this school. And he wouldn't let people study anything until they had discovered the colors that were important to them. They had painted for long enough. They'd used crayons. And then they had to play musical instruments. And then they had to learn to cook. He actually reckoned that most people were unhappy because they had no sense of taste. No sense of taste at all. Their version of taste was to listen to their peer group telling them that this was a good book, or that was a good piece of music, or that was so-and-so. Because people took away their crayons and musical instruments far too early for them to actually come to terms with what their taste was. Isn't it interesting how we have the collectivization of taste through all the magazines you have and all the rest of it? Why is that? It's because of the crashing insecurity that most people feel. You watch a bunch of middle-class people go around an art gallery, and you'll notice two things, one of which is people will only be confident in saying that something's a lovely piece of work, generally, if they know it's by someone everybody else has said is famous. The lack of confidence in terms of knowing what is good taste or bad taste or whatever, it is a sadness for all of us. It is all of us. So when you talk about education systems, I think the first thing is we need to put on a pedestal that if the most important things we have in our lives are our children, what on earth are we doing entrusting our children to the people who are in charge of them, i.e. we are making them in loco parentis? Should they not be the most important people in society? I would have thought that, I mean, with all respect to everybody else listening, I would have thought that to be an impact investor is of less importance, or should be of less importance in terms of social prestige, than being an absolutely fantastic teacher. But because we don't revere education in the way that we should and take it a bit for granted, we have not built the infrastructure to both encourage and inform teachers to become the very best they can be, nor yet given them the resources to give to our children the experiences which would be truly marvelous. Is it possible? Of course it is. Of course it is. We're humans. We're capable of getting better, but we actually need to. When you went to college, right, is it or is it not true that for other than for people who'd already got a degree and were going for a second additional qualification to enable them to teach, is it not true that the education college, the teachers' training college, was not accorded the same intellectual respect as those that were studying the big subjects? It's true, isn't it? We have actually managed to devalue teaching, and we need to work out ways of increasing the nobility of that public service.
One thing that, again, sometimes it's hard to admit ignorance, but, you know, as I am still, you know, growing up and learning, you know, and that's why, you know, I very much enjoy, and again, I really truly appreciate, you know, your time and being with us and sharing your thinking, because it's through these conversations, and I hope that people listening, you know, will benefit. Because this is fascinating, everything you just said in terms of how we are conditioned. You know, the brain has all this power, but it doesn't seem to be able to set the fire, right, until something ignites it. So lots of things that you're saying, I think, are going to really help for people to think. Because as I've learned, you know, and I moved to the UK to become an investment banker, and I was blessed to make it, you know, into the industry. And then you go in and you realize how incredible intelligent people are. You know, when they create, basically, we've been very good at creating services, right? That's one of the things that we export. Financial services products is one of them. Sometimes when you see people creating the derivative products, for example, which is basically out of air to help clients, you know, technically, but to make, you know, a lot of money. It always fascinates me how we do all of these, but we cannot do the same to create, you know, benefits, societal benefits and other benefits, which I think is all coming back to my mind when you mention all these points about how we value and how we approach things. And then because we're doing that, we're so busy, we don't take the time to reflect on some of these points. And then I'll briefly mention the fact that it's fascinating that you did archaeology, right? To start with. And then
archaeology and anthropology.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. And then one of the people I interviewed for the podcast is the CEO of Hermes, Sakir Nusebi. You know, he did history. And in this country is the one place where I've seen people that do, you know, all sorts of degrees and end up doing, you know, all sorts of other activities, you know, which I haven't seen maybe in other countries. So I'm learning to value so much more the thinking and the approaches rather than the qualifications. And well, you made a point about education, right? And how we can change it and think about it. So thank you. Thank you so much for that. If we don't mind, can I just move to talking some more about kind of the organizations, you know, and effectively they're called trust, you know, but companies that you are working, that you created, so that people again learn about it, but also get some of the inspiration in terms of, you know, how you are approaching it. So if I had to summarize it, you know, you have the Eden Trust, which is the registered charity number 1093070, if anyone wants to make a donation. And then you have Eden International, right, which sits within that, but is effectively an arm, I would call it, as I see it for now. And then specifically, you have also, I call it the drilling project, but I know that has a more sophisticated and technical name to it. So would you mind just sharing, you know, some of the work that you're doing so that people understand, because it's quite vast, really. So
I'll start with the drilling project. For 10 years, we've been trying to raise the money in order to build a deep geothermal energy plant. It's a very simple principle. Everybody listening will understand it. Jules Verne would love it. You drill down, in our case, about 4.7 kilometers into granite. We live in an area of a big granite extrusion, which is where heat is closer to the surface than going deeper. You can find heat anywhere because the center of the earth is very, very hot. In fact, the very center of the earth is hotter than the surface of the sun. But Annie, you're just digging slightly into what's called the mantle. You have the crust, which is the soil, and then you have the mantle, if you like, under it, which is the rock area. We've started drilling 5 days ago. The intention is that when we get to the 4.7 kilometers, the hot air, the hot water will be brought to the, we pump down cold water, which comes through, goes over the granite, heats up a superheated steam and comes to the surface and gives us as much hot water as we need. And assuming the temperature is right, we can use heat exchangers and it can then heat other water up to the steam required to power a turbine for about 3.4 megawatts, which would mean that the Eden project would have all the heat and power it needs and would also be able to deliver the same to 17,000 other houses nearby. Our ambition is that once we've proven this case, there's a large amount of granite near us, and we would then grow this business very rapidly because just the Cornubian, the Cornwall rock, is sufficient to provide all of the heat and power for the whole country of Britain, 20% of it. And I actually think that one of the big challenges for the UK is to suddenly allow people to rid themselves of all the brainwashing that they had about fossil fuels and realize that in a very short period of time, if we change the way we look at the world, we could become completely energy independent. Now, anybody who lives on an island anywhere must surely realize that with the lessons of history, it is wise for nations that are islands to be dependent on nobody outside their islands for anything that is vital to their existence. I would suggest that the growing of food and the production of energy would be the two key things, and you'd want to do that in the United Kingdom. And so anyway, we are hoping that in 5 months' time, the heat will come up, and we're also going to put solar panels all over our car parks and walkways. So we will be so carbon negative that my bet with my colleagues is we will be so carbon negative that even if every single one of our visitors visited from the planet Venus, we would still be carbon negative. That is a deliberate ploy. I'm a big fan of Buckminster Fuller, the late Buckminster Fuller, who designed the geodesic dome, which is the shape which makes up what Eden looks like with pentagons and hexagons. And he wrote the most extraordinary book called An Operating Manual to Spaceship Earth. And we are changing our Eden project, both here and all over the world, to make sure that we are turning ourselves into circular systems. We're moving our sewage and our water systems over the next 6 months to create systems whereby we can not only process everything on site, but we can use the wasted nutrients as feed for prawns and for fish and give us 200 tons of those and grow 40% of the vegetables that we will need on site. And we're going to basically analyze to death everything that's happening in our land to remove waste and so on. And the last point I would make about, you asked about the energy project, but it's actually right at the heart of what we're calling Eden 2.0, which is how do we make light independent? And we're hoping that within 3 years, we will be energy independent, 40% food independent, but growing everything we do eat within 1.5 kilometers of our gates. And the most important aspect is that a lot of impact investment talks about circular economies. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to let people listening know what a true circular economy is. The best way of explaining it is that in nature, there is no waste. There is no country called away to which you throw things. That means that the biodegradation of everything you create in nature, you get eaten by other things. Now, a circular economy is only a circular economy of any benefit if you're not circulating horrible rubbish. You don't want to keep circulating arsenic or single-use plastics in a particularly negative way. And a lot of people don't understand that. It's not just circular. They also use words like end of life. It's about doing things for end of life. Again, this is woolly-headed thinking. Most of the issues that you know and I know need sorting could be sorted with a change of legislation which made sure that everything that is made has got to have an end of purpose, not an end of life. It's an end of use, which means that as you design your refrigerator or your other white goods, I'm just making it could be anything, that before it's even used as a washing machine, you already know what that metal or type of junction box or whatever will be used for in its next recycling. Really healthy circular economies will have a genealogy of use already interpreted or roughed out and planned for them before you begin. I tell you what, I mean, that whole notion, I'm sure it's happened to you. Your DVD breaks down. You want to get it mended. It's cheaper to buy a new one than even mending it. That is disgusting. It is utterly disgusting that we have enshrined in our processes that sort of waste. And that's what you need people on this call to be doing. The lawyers are on it or whatever, is to think, how can you create legislation which would make a pirate smile? That's what you need to do. How could you create a taxation system which isn't about, oh, we're going to just tax the rich. It's actually about how do we encourage great investment? You know, just imagine if you were going to invest in impact investment and you didn't want to take any money out for 10 years, right? Let's say, right? Brilliant, right? Let's imagine the tax was just 10% for that. Profits from that, just 10%. You know, and the shorter it was, the tax rate just goes up and up and up and up and up and up. I mean, this would be much more your skill. But if you were acting as a citizen, you know, if you're acting as a citizen, that's what I think you'd be doing. And that is why I personally believe, and I will make a lot of enemies with my next sentence, I personally believe that the profession of accountancy, its purity in the form of audit should be removed as a profession. I do not believe it is actually a profession. I believe it is an act of treason, because as a profession, if they had actually had citizenship in mind, they would have gone back to the Roman use of the word audare, to listen, which is where auditing came from. They have never for one moment made any intelligent suggestion about how their profession can help the citizen, only the shareholder. I think they are a disgrace. I'm just saying this is a discussion point. And for all of you who are auditors out there, I'm sure you're very nice and we'd enjoy a drink together, but the shame on you for your lack of activity on behalf of all of our citizens.
Yeah, I'm going to pause there for a second for people to swallow that one. For what it's worth, you know, I'll take it. And by the way, you may not know this, but, you know, I started my career as an auditor at PwC. I'm not an auditor and I'm not in one of those firms.
I have a lot of friends who are auditors.
Anymore, but I have people very close to me that are, you know, so very interesting. But one thing I just came to my mind now with that I think the laughter just...
Can I just ask you a question then, JP, which is...
SASPI. I was going to mention SASPI. I remember. Yeah, go on.
All my friends who are auditors just look at me as if I'm being a dreamer, right? When I say to them, why on earth have you allowed this nonsense of corporate social responsibility and ESG to develop? Why? Why have you allowed something which is purest greenwashing and rubbish to develop when you could have actually thought of a law, a regulated system for companies to operate, which meant that it wasn't an externality, that all externalities which belong to us, the citizens, would be taken account of? And it's not difficult. The great late lawyer, Stephen Lloyd, made a proposition which I was fully in support of. If every company, in return for being registered as of limited liability, had to donate one special golden share to the nation, it would mean the auditors would have to say, has this company poisoned the water, the air, or the soil of the nation? And that is not preposterous. It is a moral position.
No, I think, you know, if I had to, you know, no answering for everyone, but, you know, some of the reflections I've been having is where the, I think it's morality, but then I do use a lot of the word integrity, you know, this kind of double standard between providing the service to certify something is being done according to the inverted commas standards. And again, it's very easy, not really, but very easy to just adhere to, you know, financial standards as such, almost, you know, and detached from the externalities you mentioned. But as stupid as it may sound, I just think that humans have not really evolved to understand that until now. I think the awakening, if I don't know if that's the best word to use, is kind of happening at last. You know, but I was there, you know, I couldn't see this. You know, I started developing that. Funny enough, a friend of mine started calling a call to Jesus moment, although I kind of reconnected or was reborn as a Christian only 2 years and a half ago. But, you know, let's say 7 to 10 years ago is when something triggered from my values to understand, to start thinking about some of the financing we were doing, some of the syndications we were doing. But that came, you know, I didn't hear anyone talking about it. And I do study and I do listen to, you know, I read, you know, as much as I can and listen to, you know, big thinkers, et cetera. But, and this funny thing is that, and that's again why I do, you know, the podcast, because it's to share that thinking so that more people can think about it and then we can take action. Because as I come to learn, people like yourself have been doing this for decades, or Sir Ken Robinson, right?
Yeah.
That you mentioned. So it's the challenge I haven't worked it out yet, Tim, but I'm trying to bridge that gap, you know, through, I mentioned before, through connecting people, is how do we move from now understanding, having all this knowledge, having all this experience as well, because a lot of people, you know, I always like talking about Mark Campanale, you know, who from Carbon Tracker Initiative, you know, and are there many that have been working on this for decades, you know, how do we grasp all of that now and accelerate it, right? Which we'll come back to that question, by the way. So I don't have the answer, Tim.
I wasn't expecting you to be like the Pope, mate. I wasn't. And before anybody listening thinks that I'm holier than thou, I am totally flawed in so many ways. I just think that one needs to have the conversations. You know, it's like what's going on in our cultures at the moment with Black Lives Matter and the Me Too movement. We have known culturally for I don't know, let's say 50, 100, 150 years, that we're dealing with things that aren't right. We just have never had the moment, the epiphany, if that's the way to look at it, to actually deal with it. I mean, and we should. It is morally wrong to have made the ridiculous distinction we've made over the color of people's skins and their gender. Mm. And I'm so proud of the young people that I know who regard old fogies of my generation as being like dinosaurs. And I think that's utterly marvelous. And I would say to anybody who's older like me, but I go into a lot of schools, if you're feeling depressed, don't be. The smart youngsters at the schools all over the world they're just full of brightness and quite a lot of anger about us, about how we have allowed things to get to a point where they've got, they've got the mess. But, you know, there's a great phrase by Ed Wilson, the great biologist at Harvard who invented the word biodiversity. He came up with a phrase which you must all steal when you hear this. I've stolen it. I credit it, of course, but it is, the problems for humans are that they have Paleolithic emotions, medieval institutions, and the technology of God. And that's actually a really neat quote, actually, that we've got to be quite forgiving of our failings, provided we commit ourselves to trying to put those failings right as soon as we recognize them.
Mm. Mm. Thank you for that. Thank you. I should have mentioned before, if people want to learn more about it, everything that we're talking about, the projects, you know, you should go to edenproject.com. Very simple, and you'll find all of them. But let me, again, have so many things I would like to cover, and I know that we're going to have to stop at some time. But I wanted to ask you, maybe, and I talk sometimes within kind of the theme of clients, maybe we can talk about some of your international projects, because I know that you've been, it's interesting. We went upside down. I thought we were going to go 1, 2, 3. We were going 3, 2, 1. But let me think about 1 and 2. So Eden Project. And the one thing I was thinking about, like the example you mentioned with the garden festival, what is the one big lesson? And then perhaps, because then it links nicely to, you know, why you're doing international projects, right? And how you're using all of these lessons to help internationally. Maybe does that make sense?
The question makes sense, but it's not easy to answer. The reason it's not easy to answer is, if your question is, Tim, what was the best decision you made with the Eden Project?
Oh, I like that one.
Yeah. That is quite easy. When we did our cost analysis before we built, we realized that we could not build the 3 different biomes at the size we designed them. We couldn't afford it. So the quantity surveyors said, well, look, let's do what's value engineering is the horrible phrase used for it. And we can make it all a bit smaller. You know, it won't be bad, but a bit smaller. And it was then that I made the best decision I've ever made commercially. I said, who wants to go and see the second biggest conservatory in the world? No, we will get rid of an entire conservatory and retain the ambition of the first two. And that was the right decision, because the public have poured in every year. I mean, we average 1.1 million every year now. And they're beautiful. They're absolutely beautiful, but culturally, they needed to be the size they are, to have that look and their proportion in the pit and all the rest of it. You know, and it's been great. And the other decision, I suppose, is if you take as a given that we were going to put in there the world's greatest collection of plants useful to humans, the other thing that we've done is we have an arena at Eden in which we've partnered with AEG, the world's biggest music company, because this is quite interesting.
Yes.
The majority of big rock bands are fed up playing race courses, huge stately homes and festivals, because the whole experience of the intimacy of performance and the feedback with the crowd is just lost. It just becomes like super thing. It's just about making money. And Eden, we have a brilliant arena, and this is not a boast, it's the truth. Mm. It is the best outdoor acoustic of any arena in the world. And that is an accident, to be honest, of the mining of the mine that left this brilliant tiered system there. and we can only hold 6,200 people. But all the world's big acts come and perform, and they adore it because you can hear a pin drop, by which I mean, normally when you go to a big rock concert, your ears ring afterwards. They hurt. That's because in order for you to hear the trebles and things, they turn the treble up so loud that your fillings can pick up Radio Tirana. But that's because the mid-range just gets foxed out, whereas at Eden, you hear it exactly as the artist intended. It's the only place where Elton John has ever recorded and allowed the whole concert to just be broadcast, because he sang in pitch the whole way, that he could hear every instrument. And it's very emotional. It's great. So that was the other great decision we made. Well, good decision. That's great. Was to really go for the music side of it, because people want culture. They want to be enriched by being together with themselves. You know, it's not we are very sociable creatures, and watching 6,000 people just going mad as the light fails and the moon comes up and the lights light up all the conservatories and some of the best bands in the world are playing, makes the hair stand up on the back of your neck.
And it's interesting. I've been there once, 15 years ago, and to the Gardens. I would have never actually imagined and dreamed back then that I was going to be talking to you. I was telling my family over our first lunch in the pub on Sunday, how excited I was, you know, because originally we were speaking on Monday, right? And I was like saying how fascinating, you know, how life turns. But what I was going to say is as well that always is, I've learned to appreciate that even if you look at pictures or videos, when you get there, when you get to a place like this one, it's just, you cannot describe. Again, I highly recommend, but I haven't been to a show, to a concert. So maybe that's the next thing.
That's the next thing. Maybe we'll organize that.
That's the next thing. And the other part was, okay, so that was your best decision. And this is nice. This is another first. You know, nobody asked themselves a question before. And the other one is, what about the international projects? You know, you have, you mentioned so many. I made a note. Let me just remember. So you had the China project in Xindan, Australia, Christchurch. And then you have a couple more, like Costa Rica, I think. Yes.
Yeah. Let me unpick that long sentence of yours. It's funny, but we define everything outside Cornwall as being international. We've got a big project in Qingdao, which is it's the marine capital of China. It's on the coast, but it's roughly between Shanghai and Beijing. We've got another project coming out of the ground at a place called Jizhou, which, for those of you unfamiliar with the geography of China, is a small city which is between Beijing and Tianjin. And Tianjin is, if you like, is the port of Beijing, although it's 200 kilometers away. So it's right in the middle there. And so that's been great fun. It's been a huge challenge with us getting to learn how to work with our friends in China. But China is a very, very interesting country to work in, because culturally, it has come to terms with the fact that it must adapt very quickly to turn all its energies into environmentally friendly routes. They're very upfront about the fact that their need for development throughout the 80s, 90s, and early noughties was just essential, because they needed to take the majority of their people out of poverty and into a reasonable expectation of the good things in life. And it is an astonishing act of will. But the thing is that in order to do it, it has damaged the environment very significantly, which they admit. So now every major state-owned enterprise has to have its environmental champion, and all staff need to be educated in the low impact on the environment that their activities have got to have. Our Qingdao project is right on the sea. It is actually like a broken arrowhead with the point knocked off. We have rivers on either side of the arrowhead that come to the sea. And it, like Eden in Cornwall, the land was poisoned by nitrates and the salts from shrimp farming. But now, as I speak to you, the ground floor is complete on the whole of that project, and it will be finished by the beginning of 2023. And that project is all about water, the cleanliness and importance of water, because of course the Chinese is the oldest civilization in the world today, and it was built on an understanding of water and the engineering of water. So it's actually very culturally appropriate, and it's been really sweet to see how it's been well, not only welcomed, but it's being used as a driver to make people think about water, 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 water. That in turn, sort of staying with China a bit, has led to a realization that places like the what's called the Luce Plateau, which is the most fertile part of China along the Yellow River, has actually eroded so much because of the cutting down of all the trees that there've been terrible damage. And, you know, this last century, over 20 million people died flooding. And in places, that Yellow River is 60 meters high, actually built on stilts, you know, 60 meters high to stop this happening. But if you get on a train in Qingdao and you go to Beijing, for the first hour and a bit, you just go through nurseries, lots of nurseries, tree nurseries. This is an incredible statistic. The Chinese have planted more trees in each of the last 3 years than in the rest of the world added up together, which is pretty amazing. So anyway, we're working in China. We are aware of the moral conundrums of it. I'm sure you, having heard me banging on about morality, your next question was going to be a rapier through my side, wasn't it? About how do you feel about China's relationship with some of its own people? I wouldn't duck that question. All I would say is that at present, my judgment is that the greatest problem in the world existentially is the climate and biodiversity. Therefore, if our operating in China with our Chinese friends enables us to make a real big difference in terms of awareness of all of this, it will be in terms of weighing up in balance all the considerations that one might have, would be more important than any other gesture we might make. And I would also say that we all have many friends who may have habits we don't like. The question is, at what point are they so intolerable that you actually never invite them around? I'm just really excited knowing all that you might throw at me about China. I think the people are so smart. Their commitment is so total. If I had to bank the future of the planet on one nation being able to help us get to another side, it would be China. So I would much rather be a friend of China than not so.
Wow. Thank you for the extra question and answer.
The other thing is we're in Christchurch. Christchurch is the capital of South Island, New Zealand, and we are building in the earthquake zone there. And in Australia, we are working at a place called Anglesey Mine, which is a huge coal mine, which has been restored. And in both those places, which is on the Gold Coast, you know, the Great Ocean Road below Melbourne. But both those projects, our partners are native peoples, indigenous peoples, or the traditional owners, which is what is the other way of describing people. And in Christchurch, it is with the Iwi Maori. And in Anglesey, in Victoria, it's with the Wadawurrung people. I have become fascinated late in life, having been an anthropologist, but it's really fascinating to revisit, say, one's relationships or exploring the knowledge base of indigenous peoples. And you then realize that so much of the, if you like, racist approach to indigenous people is to do with the very poor quality of translation there was of what indigenous people were saying. So you ended up with a kind of childlike commentary, which in truth bore no semblance to what their culture was like. And this last year I read a book. If anybody wants to be recommended a book that will go through your brain like a clear mountain stream, it is by a man called Bruce Pascoe. And the book is called Dark Emu. And it will leave your jaw slack. It is the true story of the colonization of Australia before the British doctored what you heard. So basically, the story we as Brits got was of Aboriginal peoples just doing hunter-gathering and then getting into dream time and all of that sort of stuff. It was rather quaint. They were supposed to be just a bit out of it. In truth, the very, very first explorers who wrote about Australia talk about towns of 7,000, 8,000 people, about fish farms and fish trapping on all the major rivers that went 30 miles up the rivers, of feasting of tribes from thousands of miles away coming to stay for a month with others. These people were brilliant. They understood how to use fire to clean scrub and so on. And that book, Dark Emu, it's the strangest of the weirdest Bibles you'll ever read, because as you read it, you wonder whether the great joke of humankind will be that a country like Australia that doesn't have very much fertility in its land may well come over the next 50 years to depend on techniques which they're rediscovering from the original owners who owned the land. So for any of you who've ever been to Australia, one of the great deserts is Van Diemen Land. Let me tell you, the Aboriginal peoples who lived in Van Diemen's Land, they discovered this extraordinary technique of making huge plates of clay, thin plates of clay with a slight curve, which they put under the desert sand so that when the dew formed at night, it would percolate through the sand and be captured in the clay trays under the sand to be able to provide the nurture, the and liquid for the oats and early corns to grow. And it's just a stunning book. Your jaw just hits the thing. And then it reproduces a letter from the Colonial Office saying there will be no mention of this. They're from now on, they're just to be indigent people who've got no stake in the land, because we do not, as Britain, want to ever have to deal with people with competing claims to land. These people are stateless, landless, and just travel around it.
The book was, again, by Bruce
Pascoe.
Pascoe. And is that... and
Dark Emu.
Emu. Thank you.
It's so exciting, JP. Isn't it funny how, when you're a bit younger than me, but in 1969, when I was sort of starting to enjoy my teenage years, and, you know, the whole world, you know, what the world is stardust, and it was hippie, and, you know, you smoked the odd joint, and it was just fantastic. You went away with the fairies. And we believed that the whole world was just full of stardust. That's what it was made. Science said that's absolutely rubbish. That's not what life is. Over the course of my lifetime, the world of scientific knowledge has come closer and closer to those early sentiments, to the point where we now know that we are made predominantly of bacteria. We have an invisible ecology of bacteria, which is stunning. Just 30 years ago, didn't almost everybody think that the Japanese were rather quaint for believing that we had a second brain? Isn't it also rather amazing that most European centers of medicine are now thinking that the stomach and the gut and whatever are absolutely central to the well-being of humans? And on the other side, you have the extraordinary work that's been done. At the moment, the best-selling book in Britain, a factual book, is called Entangled Life by Merlin Sheldrake. And that is a book about the mycorrhiza, the tiny fungi webs called the wood wide web that is in the soil. Isn't it astonishing that what was thought to be hippie shit years ago, that trees speak to each other and they communicate with bushes and they help the weakest ones survive by moving sugars around a system. And unbelievably, they look and work almost exactly the same as the microbiome in your stomach and my stomach and everything else. How lucky are our young people today in a world which has become perhaps less certain in its, if you like, spiritual direction? We live in a largely secular age. Isn't it astonishing that at such a time, science may provide an insight into life on Earth, which is truly astonishing, that we are all just creatures. We are all earthlings. And I think that's very moving. And I wish I was younger, because I think the next 15 years are going to be the most exciting since humans came down from trees to the savannas. I really do.
Nice.
And, you know, and the last thing I would say is people must stop reading newspapers. They must. They owe it to their mental health. Remember, these guys have a mantra, and their mantra is, if it bleeds, it leads. We must put bad news on the front pages because people are more interested in it. It's their psychological frisson. But after a while, it makes you mentally ill because you believe that everything's going to hell in a handcart, and it is not.
I hear you. I second it, and I actually tell that to everyone to do the same with watching the news. Just before we move away from the international side, yeah, And thank you so much for that again, Tim. Really, really value and appreciate it. And it is all gold dust. I feel that actually what we're doing right now and what you're sharing is gold dust again. So it's a good point to make. I was telling you before offline that a young lady is based out of Hawaii, connected with me, and I told her about you and the work you're doing. So I just wanted to just quickly maybe touch upon a couple of the questions as a listener that she asked. Her name is Andrea Bachman. That's a quick shout out. She works on, I'm going to try this one, it's going to be hard, Leeward Haleakala Watershed Restoration Partnership, which is lhwrp.org, and Uhiwai o Haleakala, which is uhiwai.org, and they manage about 45,000 acres in Maui, dedicated to protection and restoration. You were already answering quite a few of the questions, you know, but I thought that it would be just a couple more, perhaps, you know, because you mentioned about the specific project, but there's two maybe that come to mind, maybe three, but again, we don't have to make it too long in terms of the answer, but I'm sure that we can have even another session just with her and on this. But so how do you get these businesses? How does it work? That's what the one question I think about, you know, so maybe people like her and their organization, and what is 45,000? What does that translate into maybe for people, 45,000 acres? That sounds like a lot, right? How do they learn from people like you that are taking your experiences and your services out to other countries? How does that happen?
Generally, we get approached by people. We always say, bring us your poison. Mm. And they say, we've got some poisoned land and nasty land. Would you come work with us? So that's why we ended up in the earthquake zone in Christchurch and why we ended up at a mine in Australia. And actually, we then, the last project we've done is just about to open, is in Dubai. We've done the centerpiece for the Expo 2020, which is actually opening in 2021, which is a most extraordinary theatrical interpretation of what sustainability means. It's very rock and roll. And the Emiratis have been incredibly brave in commissioning us to do it, because it's not like any other show ever anywhere. And we're very interested in that, because Oscar Wilde always used to say, no one remembers the well-mannered person at a party. And I take that to mean that what is the point of all these boring men going around the world to conferences to make speeches that no one wants to hear, that no one will ever remember? Why did they not say something that was interesting? Why did they just say what they expected their peer group to have said? Gosh, it's so life-sapping to see them. And I hate to keep battling on with boring middle-aged men, but they tend not to deal with the real big issues. You can talk about economic botany till the cows come home, but if you're not brave enough to talk about equity, you know, you know what I mean? You've actually just, oh, I can only deal with this. But it's actually pointless if you don't stand up and deal with the big issues. So we get approached by people. We turn a lot of people down. I say, look, we're of an age that if you haven't got the money to do this, or you can't persuade the stakeholders where you are to put up the money, we're not interested, because it takes us too much time. And now we operate, all of our projects have a mix of philanthropy, state finance, and private finance. The reason is we want that healthy hybrid vigor. You want the continuous testing of the public goods with the commercial operational talents, and to also have the generosity of spirit to be able to do things that are not for strict profit, but that give great social benefit wherever you are. And most people actually applaud that. That's why in Britain, we're doing a lovely project in the Northwest in Lancashire, in Morecambe, at Morecambe Bay. And that's been great. I mean, Morecambe, as you know, it was rather haunted by a terrible accident some years ago when 20 Chinese cockle pickers got drowned. Because for those of you who are from abroad who don't know Morecambe, it is one of the wonders of the world in one particular way, that the bay, the tide comes in faster. I want you to think about this. It comes in faster than a galloping horse. Just imagine you've walked a mile out onto the sands and the tide starts coming in. It's truly terrifying. There is a man called the Queen's Master of the Sands who knows exactly when to walk the 30 miles across to from one place to the other. And it's one of the great privileges in life to be with a person who can read what looks like a landscape that no one could read and get you safely from one side to the other. Yeah. Anyway, so we're building there. unanimous desire of the people of Morecambe for us to do that. We're doing the same in Dundee, a city in Scotland, which is a very different project. I should also say that each one of our projects is different. We never copy what we've done before, and our partners are different in each.
Apologies, you remind me again. How do you spell it? Morecambe?
More, as in much more.
Yeah.
And then CAMBE, CAMBE.
Okay, perfect. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it. And then maybe I'll state the obvious, which is never great, but obviously you have millions of people visiting you, and it's a pretty well-known place and project. And also you personally have, you know, created for your scenes, you know, quite a profile, right? So that kind of marketing side is almost organic, right? So hence why you get so many people approaching you. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, but I'm pretty old and I'm pretty ugly.
But you're pretty funny, Tim.
Well, I'm incredibly lucky that people talk to me about what I've done, but they know that I'm an ordinary bloke. And it's great because people talk to me as if they've known me all my life. Honestly, I can walk through the town, our nearby town, and there'll be people I've never met who come up and they'll start talking to me as if we just met in the pub.
Yeah, and I can imagine that, yeah.
But it's such a privilege. The day you get bored or annoyed with that, you should shoot yourself. No, it is marvelous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And one thing, if you don't mind me saying, I've never met, I think, somebody that basically is insulting people, but it doesn't feel like an insult. You know, like the point you made about the auditors, the point that you are calling on all of this behavior as well, you know. So it's quite something I'm taking away definitely from you, Tim, and I have to learn, you know, because I think I picked up some of the many things you share, where it comes from, like the Oscar Wilde phrase that you quoted. But I think it's quite a skill.
One of the things, JP, is this, that I, just like you, am a very flawed person. I'm a very flawed person.
Yes, amen.
And therefore, when I criticize auditors, I'm doing it in fellowship, not in enmity.
Yeah.
Because I recognize that they're as flawed as I am. And I also know that an awful lot of my auditor friends would like to be better than they are professionally, just like I would. And I think provided your criticism is, if you like, the criticism of a brother rather than someone who's trying to create a war, you can achieve far, far more. And the way you do that is by just being lightly humorous. You've got to be lightly humorous. The trouble is, no one changes their mind when you behave like an old-fashioned Old Testament prophet and wag your finger and tell people that there's going to be fire and brimstone and that you are behaving just terribly. I don't know about you, but I have never, ever changed my opinion when someone shouted at me.
I hear you.
Marvelous.
Question about, you've done all of this. You mentioned you do all the projects are different. You know, you've been around. We actually didn't touch. You mentioned SDGs briefly at the beginning, but people are kind of getting obsessed about the whole measurement, right? Piece, impact measurement. And I didn't try to find if you had a specific methodology or because the diversity of what you're doing, but do you have any one thing that you, with the trust, measure or a methodology that people should check out?
The lying answer is lots of things, lots and lots of things. The truth, no. I think we do measure our carbon.
You mentioned before, yeah, you're going to measure, like the data is your thing because you measure, you know, consequences of every action you take on the land, et cetera.
On the land and on the water and on the carbon, yes, we do. But we're very nervous about all of this because we've created a dialogue around carbon, which is very unhealthy. Carbon is the building block of all life on Earth. And we seem to be treating it like it's a cancer we're suffering from. The problem is we've got fugitive carbon. You know, it's kind of like escaped, come out too quickly. And we need to work out how, you know, I mean, if you look at the soil of Britain, in fact, the soil of the world, it was probably around the carbon in the soil in Roman days than it is today. So if you look at all of the land that is currently farmed and you imagine actually farming it healthily, that's a heck of a lot of carbon you can absorb. That's a lot of carbon you can absorb. If you then stop putting shit into the oceans and enable us to stop putting chemicals into the sea that are bad for the sea, and then your phyto and zooplankton start to grow exponentially, they absorb more carbon than the whole of the rainforest of the world. We've just got to see this as a big challenge to just behave badly. We're like an annoying teenager that needs to bloody well clean up their room. When you start seeing the human species like that, it becomes just a bit easier. The thing I haven't talked about, which of course you were about to ask me about, was about, are we going to have something on every inhabited continent? Well, at the moment, we have a project on every inhabited continent. We've got one in Australia and Christchurch, that's Australasia. We've got China, which is Asia. We've got a project which is really exciting and really dangerous in Chad, in the middle of Africa. In Europe, obviously, we've got our own projects. In America, we've got a project in South Carolina at a place called Graniteville. And then in Latin America, Central Latin America, we have the coolest project you can imagine in Costa Rica, where we have got a 10,000-acre rainforest that was, this goes back to the start of the interview, this goes back to impact investing, right? Those acres, 10,000 of them, were part of a 42 different farms where the land was degraded, and the Danish philanthropist who purchased it, what he did was, he was called Peter Kolind, and he put a fence around all 10,000 acres. And you know what he said? No humans may go in here for the next 20 years. The birds will shit it back to life. So this countryside, at Matambu, which is in the Nicoya Peninsula on the Pacific coast of Costa Rica, the nearest town was called Paquera, a place of 8,000 souls. Every year there were murders. Many murders because of drought. The water ran out, and for 5 months of the year, livestock died. People were in great poverty until the rainforest started to grow back. And then you should hear the mayor of Paquera talk about the majesty of seeing the heat haze over the mountain suddenly create clouds and rain would fall. And year by year, this whole new vision erupted. So today, for 365 days of every year, four rivers flow out of that rainforest, and they provide the water for Paquera. The people of Paquera believe that they've had a second coming. They actually believe it is religious, that they've been given a second chance of life. So they formed their own fire brigades to make sure there are no fires as a voluntary activity. And we're now talking to them with our friends at Hotel Chocolat, to see about growing forest cacao, cocoa, to create livelihoods, because one of the really important things about the wild is we must not think of humans and the wild having to be kept separate. That's how you create enemies. What you need is to find ways in which humans can work in and with the wild. So we're looking with Hotel Chocolat about how can we create a brand within Hotel Chocolat to raise funds to buy more land, to put it into protection, and to pay good livelihoods to the people of Paquera. And this is all really, really exciting to look at, because that's what we started when we were talking about impact investment. That is real impact investment. And let me tell you, the biggest impact on us who work on that project was just 2 months ago. We put heat-seeking cameras in that rainforest. And about a year ago, we got our first ocelots started to come in, and puma. But 2 or 3 months ago, I can't remember exactly which day, we got the first pictures back from the middle of the jungle of a jaguar. Now, isn't that cool that you've got the regeneration of 10,000 acres of forest? We're going to create an economic use for it. Biodiversity is back and growing all the time. And this is humans being smart. So everybody who's an impact investor or listening today should be so excited about the potential of your money, because if you invest your money right, you will not only get a return on that money, but you will get this incredible buzz in your soul for the excitement of the things you've been able to, giving nature a helping hand to put it right. And that has got to be something that must be, surely, of all the rewards you can get on planet Earth, to have the chance to put your intelligence to work, to give nature a helping hand and make a little bit of money on the side. Isn't that nobility? Isn't that truly happiness?
Yes. Yes. And the big point there is how environment and nature, you know, creates effect on the society that, you know, people, because that's the other part about measurement that people keep talking about, you know, that they struggle with the societal impact, but in many, many cases, it's a bit more long-term. And it's interesting you mentioned, what was the name of the Danish man again?
Peder, spelled P-E-D-R.
Yeah.
Kolind, spelled K-O-H-L-I-N-D. And his son is the Eden Project lead in that rainforest project today.
Nice, nice. And it's interesting because I mentioned to you there is a younger generation guy called Zac Efron, which is a film star, you know, quite famous. And he has a series of documentaries. I don't know if you've seen them, Down to Earth. And this,
yeah,
one of them, which is in Costa Rica, where they show, I don't know, actually, I'm going to double check if it is maybe the same place, because they show how terrible it was before they closed everything, before they started doing the regeneration. And it only, I think it was within 5 or 10 years, the whole biodiversity kind of was reinstalled. So I remember that. And it's funny, coming from a hot country and Latin America, had never seen a cacao before. So I saw it on that documentary for the first time, you know, how they take it out and how they eat it. And it's a beautiful, sorry, I'm going to sound ignorant again, but it's okay. It's a flower, right? So it's the, and then they open it and it's like, and it comes like this beautiful, and they describe it. I haven't seen it actually in my life. So
imagine a very, very big avocado that is yellow, an ochre-y type yellow with a bit of coppery brown. And that would be it. They are amazing because light...
But that's outside, right? But then inside is white, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, when you cut it open, you have a white pulp all around it. And then you have the cacao seeds.
Yeah.
But actually, those who live in cacao-rich countries know that the pulp is even better than the cacao. I mean, it's lovely. Mm. And in Argentina and in Brazil, the greatest delicacy, the favorite fruit, is in fact a member of that cacao family. The Latin of it, coco, is called Theobroma cacao, but the fruit which is so prized in Brazil and Argentina is called Theobroma grandiflora, which is just the pulp. It's basically a relative, which without the cacao seeds is just that pulp, which is just amazingly amazing. I'm glad the West has not caught on to that, or else we'd be cutting even more down. I'm joking. It is beautiful. The other interesting thing about cacao, just like coffee, what's the word for it? When you see it growing, the little flowers come out on the bark of the tree, as opposed to like ordinary flowers at the end of the leaves and whatever. These are actually coming out the bark of the trees and the main branches. They're like little yellow flowers, and they suddenly start turning into a pod. And then they grow like they're sucking the tree dry. They're big. And it's amazing. We've got 27 varieties of cacao at Eden. If you're feeling as if your life has not been valued enough because you've never seen cacao, come to Eden. What an irony that a man of the South Americas should come to Cornwall to see his native fruit.
I promise you, because I am on this kind of awareness journey, right? When I saw that, and I thought, like, how come I never actually seen a cacao? You know, it just really caught my attention, and it was like nothing what I could have imagined. So I thought it was worth mentioning. So thank you very much for the descriptive explanation as well. I'm sure that people will be just imagining just by listening to it. Listen, Tim, as we start wrapping up, interesting, I have like the last couple of questions, and one of them is kind of to dig a little bit more about you, but it's been fascinating because, you know, I tend to ask people what drives them, what you care most about. I think it's all kind of very self-evident. Who inspire you? But also you mentioned so many people, friends and others, but perhaps I don't know if it's two things that, you know, and again, you have had the most amazing and rich life. Just reading about you, if you don't mind me saying, it just energized me, you know, just reading all the activities, you know, what you've done, how you've gone about it. And I think the same happened to Andrea when she didn't know about you. And I told her, oh, I'm going to have this conversation with Tim Smith. Do you know him? And he's like, no. She went away. And I told you, I'm going to share some of the things that she wrote to me. What you generate, right, is truly, truly inspirational. And we were talking about before, you studied in Sussex, in Kent, you know, so kind of close to where I am now. But is there like one or two like really pivotal moments, you know, that in your life that you went like that kind of made it, or perhaps linking it to someone in your life that made that happen?
I was very lucky that I was sent to an English public school against my wishes. I hated very much the loneliness of being, just before my 7th birthday, arriving at a prep school in Britain, because my dad worked for KLM Airlines And he was posted to Turkey, and there were no English or Dutch schools there. So I was sent to England because my mother was English, my father was Dutch. And I was very lucky that there was a master who had this extraordinary moustache. You know, it was like a walrus moustache. And he had these piercing eyes and glasses and always wore a tweed jacket with leather patches. And he could recognize every bird outside, every tree outside. And he loved nature, but he talked about it as being just this amazing gift that we'd been given to land in this place. And his job was to reveal the secrets of the natural world. So we would start to compete, seeing the most amount of birds, and we would look under rocks and looking for toads and things. And that smell of, as you lift a rock and the ferns get crushed, that moist soil and crushed fern, just like when you go pond dipping, that smell of pondweed, mud and slightly stagnant water just brings back an ocean of memories. And that was combined in this extraordinary man who every day he ate a raw onion just by slicing one bit off after another and would swallow it. And he said it'd be a secret of a long life. Well, I'm not exactly sure whether it was a secret of a long life, but he inspired so many of us, because in the evening, and he didn't have to, we all lived in dormitories, and he'd come and he would read us these great adventure stories. So we'd be tucked up in bed and he would get onto this throne-like wooden chair. And he would read us things like King Solomon's Mines and The Lost Worlds by Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes and Brigadier Gerard. So my whole brain was populated by adventurers and extraordinary encounters in the pages of these books. And then in daytime, I was sort of kind of being shown the natural world as if it was also this immense privilege and we had to grab it as if we were thirsty for knowledge right now because we'd never get the chance again. He was just the most brilliant and inspirational teacher. And it's very funny, he was called Tom Gilbart, and I did an interview with the Times Educational Supplement some years ago, and I just happened to mention that he'd been my great inspiration, not knowing that his son was a huge fan of the Times Educational Supplement. And he phoned me up because he said it was just such a lovely thing to see his dad remembered in that way. But I say this to all adults listening right now, is that example has made me very aware that I must make time. I must make time to read my grandchildren's stories and whatever, because it's only the people closest to you that make themselves close to you that can actually convey the essence of who you are in terms of what excites you, so that they will remember you long after you're dead, but with a warm smile because you created these unforgettable moments. And I feel very sad for people who are a bit like me and probably a bit like you, who perhaps think you're doing something really important by working that extra hour or doing that extra deal or whatever. How sad are we? We should also give ourselves a good slapping with a bit of wet fish and commit ourselves to making sure that every month we've given each one of the people that's valuable to us a memory, a moment that they will carry warmly for year after year. And I think that's a terrific thing to put down as don't make it a New Year's resolution. Mm. Be random, be brave, make it a end of May resolution, because that way you're bound to keep it.
Very nice. Very nice. I'm very intentional about that. I have it on my kind of weekly and daily, you know, even if it is just by using technology on the better way, you know, just kind of texting somebody or calling somebody, or especially my daughters. I think I try to like just be on their minds as much as I can, because it takes nothing these days, right? So nothing in terms of, you know, it's almost automatic, you know. We have the technology of God. I'm going to use that one.
Well, can I tell you one last thing on this?
Yeah, yeah.
When I learned to scuba dive, in 1972, and I went to a place called Fort Bovisand in Plymouth. And it was me, imagine this, a slightly podgy middle-class boy and six men from the special boat squadron. They were like really tough. And anyway, at the end of the 6 weeks of dive training, they held this party and they invited me to join them because they thought it was antisocial. And at the end of it, we drank a lot of whiskey and suddenly they all stood up. They said, 1, 2, 3, 4, it's 4 a.m. Aberdeen, we're in. And everybody punched their fists together. I did it, of course. And I said, what have I just punched the air for? I just thought I was like a sheep. And they said, it's 4 a.m. You've committed the worst crime that is possible. You're in the worst trouble, the worst deprivation. Just imagine the worst thing. Who will you call? What you've just pledged is that you will be available for a phone call. Now, what's really interesting about that is they then said, you need to go through your address book and find the four people that you would entrust with your life. And I discovered something incredible in doing that, that many of the people you socialize with or spend time with, you would not trust your life with. And yet some of the people you have ignored over years, but you still keep vaguely in touch with, they are special, but you've somehow taken them for granted. So I think as well as finding stories for your children, go through your address book and think of the people that actually matter to you, but you've taken them so much for granted, you haven't bothered to make a call or write a letter or arrange for anything. And I say this to all my mates and they all say, thank you, I've just done that. And it was different. We're all like that. We lead lives where we forget, we just do the urgent rather than the important.
I'm going to do it. So I'm going to take that. And I'm last two. And actually, one of them may be already answered with what you just said, you know, which is I tend to ask for kind of a final call to action, but maybe you can do one more specific to even more specific to Eden and to, you know, your area or to impact investing, right? But you also mentioned a few as well through the conversation, which I really appreciate. And one last one on the back of Tom Gilbert, you know, and everyone that you have worked with and met through your life in terms of being what I call an impact leader, right? So what makes, you know, an impact leader, you think, in terms of actions or characteristics?
I think impact leaders are very interesting psychologically because in order to be effective, they need to be vain. They need to have a degree of arrogance. And yet at the same time, they have to be able to ride the horse of humility. It is almost that contradiction which makes people special because they know that nobody wants to get on a stage with people who are saying it's my idea, my idea, my idea. And yet they also know that you need to be strong enough to have the idea to actually create something that people, if you like, coalesce around. So impact leaders are very interesting people in general. They are a bit schizophrenic in terms of their self-knowledge about their vanity and also their humility, which is bonkers. I feel it in myself. I'm sure you do. It's a very funny thing. Mm-hmm. I think because also we are all plagued by feeling like imposters. You know, we all think we're imposters. A great chum of mine was the boss of Rolls Royce. And I asked him how he felt. He said, I just don't believe that I got away with it. And everybody I know who's successful, they say, it's lucky, isn't it? Because no one actually believes they're worthy of the big things. But all I would say is that if you're lucky enough to be there, actually, one of the most endearing things is to admit you don't have all the answers, but be very arrogant about saying my skill is finding the people who are clever enough to know those answers. And that's what I'm good at. So that way you don't have to take any of the responsibility for the good ideas, but you do take the responsibility for having created the most wonderful group of people that are going to deliver those ideas.
Amen. So vain, arrogant, humble. With a bit of schizo, a bit impostor, it's all good. But it's something that I've been experiencing for some reason this year, if I may share, which is, you know, quite liberating, you know, through, it happens to be for me, that is through my life experience and then now through Jesus and God and the study of the Bible. That worth it part that you mentioned, that when you realize that really that you are not worth it, it's another way to liberate yourself from seeking worth. That's what I always tell people, even if you don't believe, some of the concepts are quite interesting. And I like that word liberating, because once you realize that it's not about you and it's really about others and the bigger cause. And you mentioned it before in one of the answers around, you know, going out there and helping and doing good. And maybe you said in different words, you know, that's what really, really matters. Kind of what people, from reading to your grandchildren and to helping anyone, because that warm feeling in your heart that you leave on people, you know, where there is that phrase, you know, people forget what you say, but they never forget how you make them feel. Yeah. I love that. I love that phrase. So I'm learning, you know, I'm learning. So thank you for that. I appreciate it. And then the last one is, you know, any final call to action and how can people get in touch with you?
Well, you can get in touch with me at tsmit@edenproject.com. It comes straight to me. No dots, tsmit, T-S-M-I-T, at edenproject.com. And if it was a call to action, it would be just say something every day that shocks people. I don't mean that you start swearing as if you've got some kind of mental problem. I mean, be thoughtful and don't become the person that other people have carelessly thought you are. Always be an act of growth. I need to share one thing with you, actually.
Please.
That at the age of 37, I made a decision which changed my life. Unlike you, it wasn't to find God, it was to find chance. I realized that if I wanted to live a life of ordered boredom, I would do what people expected of me and I would meet the people that I was expected to meet. And I realized that the truly interesting people were the people you didn't know you needed to meet. And the only way I could meet people like that was to accept every third invitation I receive. It's not that I don't accept the first, but I always accept the third. And the reason for that is only that way can you put yourself in the social jeopardy of meeting a new group of people. And for you to be healthy, you must always be meeting new people. And if you want to know why, there's a brilliant book called Some by David Eagleman, which is a humorous book, but it starts, each chapter is only 3 pages long, and it starts by saying, imagine you're going to die and all your friends die with you and you're going to paradise. Look around you and now imagine eternity. Think about it. Think how boring that would be to be with the same people all of that time. The downside, the other side of that is the other part, which is to not persuade yourself that your best friends were always made at school and at university. In Britain, this is a real illness. It means that people are not open to making new friendships. And actually, to keep yourself always open to making new friendships is a really healthy thing. Because actually, if you're a good judge of character, it will only take you a couple of days to work out whether someone is to your liking, because you're cleverer now that you're the older age you were. You don't need to share smelly socks and bad food with people at university and school over 3 years. You can do it in 2 days. So get out there, meet new people, and it'll change your life. It changed mine, absolutely.
Yeah, well, it's changing mine. And, you know, you're my new best friend, Tim, so... but it's exactly that, you know, and I do like pointing out to people what you just said, you know, the fact that we are talking, the mention, the fact that Andrea, that all the way in Hawaii, found out about you. And is this, the world today has so many ways also to meet people, you know, physically, virtually, and virtually beyond actually meeting. And hopefully this episode is going to go around and the video, you know, to touch a lot of souls and brains. So really, really appreciate it, Tim. Thank you so, so much.
My pleasure. My pleasure. It's Friday night here.
Friday, then, you know that song? Saturday, Sunday.
Yeah, indeed, indeed.
So
I shall now go out and walk some dogs whose legs are crossed.
Very, very good. So just before I go, let me read just the end part of the episode so that you enjoy as well, which is to take the opportunity to invite anyone that is listening to partner with me and Impact Leaders. We want to help and do more to raise awareness and create action beyond sustainable and impact investing, as you can tell. So the podcast is one of the catalytic initiatives that we are running. If you want to become a patron now, we have the opportunity. So you can go to bit.ly/LLPpatron. And yeah, so thank you in advance. And the last part is that we're also looking for 3 founder sponsors to support our mission to enable the transition of capital, and specifically also for 10 impact leaders interested to join our program that we actually just launched. So you can register your interest, contact us through the page, or contact register your interest on bit.ly/IL Club and capital L to register your interest again. So it is bye for now until our next amazing episode of Impact Leaders, and God bless you all. Thank you. Thank you for listening to Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by ILA and partners. Please connect with us to work together in the transition of capital into sustainable and impact investing.